My name is Lucia Heinold, and I'm a Unitarian Universalist in terms of my church background, and currently a member of the ICPJ Racial and Economic Justice Task Force.
And I'm LaRon Williams, and I joined the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice about 2008. And at the time that I joined, there was a requirement that you serve on one of the task forces, the existing task forces. And I chose the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force because it fit with work that I had already been doing. I sought out ICPJ after a multiple-year absence from political activity because I wanted a way to practice, to put into practice the ideas that I had in my mind. And I had known for a long time that you can't accomplish anything as an individual, even if you work with organizations on a piecemeal basis, that it's better to work on a consistent basis with somebody. And I had an opportunity to replace an existing steering committee member who was leaving. And so when I was asked, I jumped at the opportunity and joined ICPJ.
And my story is really very similar. The person who represented, well, the person from our church who was on the steering committee resigned, or her term was up, and they were looking for someone from our congregation, mainly because we have an associated fund called the Jackson Welfare Fund that has been a supporter of ICPJ and ICPJ's work on First Amendment rights for decades. So I was asked if I would do that, and so I stepped up and did it. And it was wonderful for me. It was good timing because I had retired in 2006 and joined the church in 2006 and was just kind of getting my local social justice connections going. When I was working, I worked on committees in the company. I was at Borders, and we had committees working on affinity and increasing opportunity and all that kind of thing, and I did that. But once I retired, I knew, like LaRon, that I wasn't going to be very effective on my own. I needed organizations to work through, and the first one was the church, and the second is ICPJ.
And you won't hear me make references to a religious affiliation because even though I was raised Baptist, and a very serious Baptist at the time that I was attending church very regularly, when I became a young adult, I started to see the hypocrisy in my family's church, and so I started to look for something that was more consistent, and I just haven't yet reattached myself to an established religious institution. But one of the things I liked about ICPJ, and one of the things I discovered over the many, many years that I was involved in political activity, is that quite often it was people of faith, people who talked about their religious faith, who seemed to be making the strongest effort to incorporate within their personal lives the values and the beliefs that they espoused on the political slash social level. So I liked that aspect of conversation with people and that aspect what's the old women's liberation expression? Being the change that you want to see. That people of faith were doing that more than anybody else. Now, I had lots of disagreements with many religious institutions, and especially the kind of fanaticism that I frequently saw. But I really liked that potential for having constructive conversation and constructive activity around being, living the embodiment of what you really believed. So, and I still like that piece of it. I mean, I'm not a religious person, and yet I'm a member of the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice. So I like that aspect, the inclusivity. Well, let me backtrack a tiny bit. When I joined the steering committee, there was an existing practice of assigning to new members of the steering committee a kind of a buddy, a person with whom you would sort of apprentice to learn the ropes. And I don't remember the last name of the person that I apprenticed with, but her first name was Lori. And Lori was African American, and she was on the Laura, and she was on the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force, and of course I already had an interest in that, but then I just got onto the task force that she was on. Now, she wasn't with ICPJ too much longer after that, just a few months, in fact. But that was one of the mitigating factors. If I can remember who was there, there were maybe five regular members at the time, some of whom are still still with us. Mary Browning was definitely there, and Jim Mogensen. Others, oh gosh. Well, Grace Cotry was there because there was a staff person on, I think at the time each of the committees had a staff person assigned.
They did.
Yeah, every committee had, or every task force rather, had a staff person, and Grace was on, was with our group. So I'll let you talk for a second, Lucia, and then I'll come back to what the atmosphere was like when I got there.
Okay. I don't remember any other names. I remember that Grace was our staff person until about 2 years ago or whenever they changed things a little bit, and that she was wonderful to work with, and she led us to a lot of connections that I don't think we had before, like with the Restaurant Opportunities Group in Detroit, I was also on the Hunger Task Force at the time, and that was when we came up with having the Faith in Food Gardens, and that was an exciting project, too.
And I was only on the one task force, but one of the things I think at the time, aside from Laura, that I was the only African-American member of the task force. Oh, no. Yes, I was. Yeah, I was. The only African-American member of that task force. And I noticed immediately, after about a year, that the language, the ways that I heard people approaching race and racism were, to me, reminiscent of a way of thinking about racism from the 1960s or so, that people still tended to speak of it as if it were simply an attitude problem. And I noticed the same thing was true within the organization in general, that whenever I went to sat in on other task forces or even in the steering committee meetings, I wasn't hearing the words that reflected an understanding that racism was more than just individual interpersonal relationships. So early on, I pushed for the creation of a kind of a study segment within the task force so that we would study different book titles and try to, in my words, put us all on a similar footing, on the same page, at least with our language around those kinds of things. And so we created a book study group within the REJ. And at first, it was just for REJ people. But it blossomed into something else that continues to exist now.
Talk about some of the things you read.
Well, let me also add this quick point, that because of the noticing that each of the task forces seemed to be using the language from the past, I also did a series of training sessions with all the task forces where I just went to each task force and talked about race and racism and talked about it as an institutionalized phenomenon within our society and did a little history and particularly talked about three areas that Americans have a lot of trouble with in making progress with race, that we tend to think of ourselves as already fair. So we've sort of declared that our society is equal, but we don't see the ways that racial hierarchy has been built into has been structurally built into so much of what we do. So the example that I always use to try to make it clear to people is that if you are a left-handed person, so I talk about different aspects of inclusion and exclusion. So if you're a left-handed person, you're automatically excluded by structural aspects of our society. For example, we have all kinds of tools that are made for right-handed people, and lefties have a very hard time with those tools. Now, people who make those tools don't sit around thinking, I hate left-handed people, but they create those tools in a way that makes it easier for right-handed people to use and harder for lefties to use. So I always start out talking about handedness because it doesn't carry the kind of weight that race does. But then I talk about structuralized racism as well, and the ways that our language favors, along racial lines, it favors whites and disfavors people of color, and the ways that, it's so widespread that there are multiple ways that we favor whites along racial lines. So the first thing is the assumption of fairness. The second thing is the assumption that the ways that things are neutral and not biased. And that's a very similar explanation. And then there's the assumption that by making an effort to make things fair, that's all that's important. And the way that I try to show that is I use a hotel key card that has on it several languages that, including English. It has several languages on it, including English, but English is centralized on the card and in much bigger letters than anything else. And so even though there's an attempt to be fair, the bias is still there because this card just screams that English is the language, and even though we're trying, we're not quite there yet. So my hope by showing some of those things is that people begin to see other ways that our society includes and excludes people. So I did these workshops with all the task forces, and the language has changed within the organization, which is good.
Well, I think we should also give a lot of credit to Chuck, because as our the director for the 8 years or so that we've been involved, he has been working very hard to lead us in building connections with African-American and other people of color in the community, because the group, with the exception of Laurent, really didn't have much of any personal connection. And he's done a lot of work building relationships with Brown Chapel and bringing people of color like Jeff Harold onto the board, also reaching out to Muslims and others. And as you do, the wider that net of connections is, the more you begin to see how overwhelming the systematic racism is, because it's just affects everything that people of color deal with all the time. Not to mention that we are unaware of what we're losing by this system that we have. We lose all kinds of enrichment in terms of personal connections and cultural knowledge. And so I do think that the fact that he has been so willing to work with you and support your leadership on this has been great.
We also had the benefit a few years ago of being able to tie into the Understanding Race project that was going on here and the exhibit at the Museum of Natural History. So the entire community really was more alive with these issues than it had been ever. So that was a big help. It also was very busyfying.
Yes, indeed. Well, Laurent was he was part of the committee with the university people, weren't you? The rest of the three of us, Mary and Jim and I, we were logistics, trying to get people to things and get food to things, publicize things, get ourselves to things.
Well, personally, there was no aspect of it that I wasn't involved with. In fact, I was a little surprised when somebody read a list of all the things that I had been working on. I wasn't even aware that I had done so many things. So, So this is both as a member of RAJ and as an individual that things were happening for me. But we created a series of, well, first of all, there was the exhibit, and then we created a team of people who were trained to lead discussions around the exhibit. So they talked about what was in it, and after each tour of the exhibit, they also did a kind of debriefing sessions. So I was involved in training those people, and Jeff Harold was one of the people who was in those groups. So we created that group. We also had a series of community conversations that were ongoing and are kind of, right now, they're at rest, but we hope to resurrect them fully again. There were connections that had to be made between the various aspects of the Understanding Race Project. So, for example, the Neutral Zone was asked to be involved. And so I did presentations to the Neutral Zone to get them on board with what the nature of the exhibit was and to ask them to be a part. I did a presentation for the staff at the museum because the bringing in the exhibit was the idea and sort of the work of a few people on the staff, but not everybody knew everything about it. So we did a little thing with helping them to get on board. I did a one-man show, three people show in a sense, at the Michigan Theater. University of Michigan was involved and had a theme semester. And so as part of that theme semester, using the University of Michigan's clout and connections with the Michigan Theater, I was able to do a presentation there of a story, an extended story that I've written called Elm Park 1955. So that was presented at the Michigan Theater. So many things. At the same time that the Understanding Race Project was going on, there were discussions going on. And actually, I had been in discussions with people in Ypsilanti trying to expand the ground that was covered by the exhibit. And I talked with a staff person at the Ypsilanti Library downtown branch, the Michigan Ave branch, about holding a film and discussion series there at the library. But it didn't come to fruition. But a few years later, the library called me back up again because they were interested in picking up that idea. This was a different library. This was the Whitaker Road Library that contacted me with wanting to explore that idea again. And I don't know if we've already mentioned the creation of I did mention the creation of the book study within REJ, which eventually grew to become a book study group that anybody could come to, and it's ongoing. So once a month we read from a title of some kind. But at one point we were interested in watching some films instead of doing books. And so I suggested to the Ypsilanti Library that we could have the two films that we were going to watch as a book group could be the two inaugural films for their series, and that it could be co-sponsored by the Racial and Economic Justice Book Group and the Ypsilanti Public Library. And so the Safely Talking, it was titled Safely Talking and Safely Learning About Race and Racism. And that's been a tremendous success. Attendance has been high, the support on the part of the library has been very high.
And maybe we should say, I mean, attendance has been 50 or more at each film, which is really a good attendance for something, programs about a topic like this.
Yeah. And they put out 15 chairs the first week. They had set up 15 chairs expecting they might get 15 people. And so when we had to keep bringing chairs in, there were 50, more than 50 people at that first session. And I think it speaks to the title. I mean, it was very deliberate to say safely talking and safely learning about race and racism, and the emphasis was on, and there was a write-up about it, the emphasis was on creating safe spaces where we could engage this very difficult social issue, very difficult but very influential social issue. I think, too, that a little piece of it was that, and Matt may not know this, but I'm pretty well known in the community as a professional storyteller. And so sometimes people come to things that I'm part of just because the storyteller is going to be there. And I think that may have been a little bit true with that first one.
I guess it matters to me because, in talking from a faith perspective, we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And so many conditions around us don't reflect that opportunity for so many people. We are not the only group that's trying to provide safe spaces. There is another group in town, the Race Dialogues group, that came out of a visit from Naomi Tutu back in 2008 again. That year keeps popping up. And they also try to provide spaces, but they have structured time frames. You have to sign up for 6 conversations in a row, so you get comfortable with each other. We thought we needed to have 2 kinds of spaces, the study group, which has brought people from the community from different perspectives in to learn the new thinking and also to act. The action piece didn't turn out to be as much as we had hoped, but partly that's because almost everyone who comes to the study group is already actively doing something. So in the early, was it 2010, after the Pioneer, the 3 high school kids were arrested at Pioneer High School after a football game, many people in the study group were part of the community effort that was picketing and demonstrating for reasonable sentences for those people. Other people in the group are there because of personal run-ins with the system and looking for support. So they need that. But the Ypsilanti film series is really important, I think, because one, people can just come and go and don't have to sign up for a lengthy program. And the other piece of it is that we, for ICPJ, we are trying to build our presence on the eastern side of the county, and this film series is a wonderful step in that direction. We're doing some other things. For example, last night I was at a Ypsilanti school board meeting to support restorative justice programs in the schools, which are very important to the minority students. So the film series is really just a wonderful way of spreading the word that we care about Ypsilanti, and I think it's going to lead, well, we're meeting people in the film series who are going to be our allies in future ICPJ justice work.
And I think back when I first started talking with the Ypsilanti people about doing a film series, you know, the recent, let's call them recent revelations, although longstanding practices of police brutality, you know, the presence of handheld cameras that anybody can carry and capture what has really been going on has kind of catapulted a lot of reality into the current news coverage. But ICPJ did a series. There was a focus on the economy. And I don't remember the title of that series. Do you remember, Lucia, when we focused on understanding economics, understanding the economy, the role that economics plays in all of, across the board, in all kinds of things, and we showed the why are people poor?
The end of poverty. We showed a film about alternative economies. My head hurt. Because just trying to think about ways of doing, meeting needs without money. I mean, I felt that this was really a challenging concept and worthwhile.
Yeah. So that was an issue that's how I started the discussions with the people in Ypsilanti. We were talking about the growing, increasing extremes of wealth and poverty, and why those things were happening, and talking about the 0.1% to which most of the wealth has accrued over the past 10 years or so, and talking about the huge numbers of people who don't have wealth. And I started talking about the ways that race and class have been cemented throughout our history, and how difficult it is for people to talk about both of those things, that we don't have much of an understanding. There are sort of three areas of life that we don't get an education around in school: race, class, and gender or sex. They don't talk about how those things have played out throughout our history. So here we're having this discussion about that, and I just said, you know, that my fear, one of my fears, is that as these extremes continue to grow, if people don't develop the kind of compassionate understanding of who we are as individuals within this changing scheme of things, then we're going to start to tear each other apart. Or we'll be held in check by this, like, strong-armed garrison state, you know, that's the only thing that will keep us in check. And I said, we have to learn to care about each other much more just because we're human. Just because we're human. And so I think that's kind of what piqued the interest of the library in doing the thing, was that just because we're human, we're going to start to learn how to care. And also, it coincided or came just after or just before the book group, the Racial and Economic Justice Book Group, read the book by Michelle Alexander.
The New Jim Crow.
The New Jim Crow. Just before we read The New Jim Crow. And so The New Jim Crow, as you know, that's like set the country on fire. She did such great homework in talking about one system within many, one system of racialized control within many. And I'm a strong proponent in helping people to understand that that's just one system. There are lots of others that do the same kind of thing that may not be quite as obvious as the criminal justice system, but they work in the same way. So Michelle Alexander's book coming out helped to explain for a lot of people what was going on within that one system, to the degree that people felt there were things, because she even makes suggestions in the book of certain things that people can do. They felt, well, there's something we can do. And one of the things the Ypsilanti Library thought they could do was at least educate people about our real history. And so that's what the series tries to do.
In spite of all the terrible news, there's good news, too. The fact that the restorative justice trend here in our county is increasing with Judge Connor's Peace Court, with a new group that includes some ICPJ members, that is, one, learning to actually participate in restorative justice work with the county, and also to educate people. Different churches are putting on a play, trying to explain what it is, that it's not be easy on criminals. It does include restitution, but it's a much healthier way of doing things. And I see a lot of new connections with that are hopeful for the schools and for ICPJ. As far as mass incarceration, there seems to be a lot of hope. At least Joe Summers is my major contact with this business, but Reverend Joe Summers is part of a group called the Coalition, which is meeting in Lansing, trying to develop a strategy for changes in mass incarceration in Michigan. And the program includes many, many steps that lead to sentencing reform and better programs for juveniles, much more sensible parole conditions. So that gives me some hope there. So those are two things that I see as hopeful.
Yeah. I like those. Lucia has heard me address this several times. So hope is important. Hope is very important. And I always talk about signs of hope, that hope is seeing signs. It's seeing things that are happening that reinforce, hey, something's going on, and I'm grateful for that. I'm glad. But I always talk about so faith to me is very important, even though I don't talk about a faith tradition. So, I mean, I come out of a tradition of faith. I come out of the African-American struggle to simply survive in the Western Hemisphere and to go on day after day after day, never seeing a sign that this is necessarily going to change. You know, I think about living under slavery for hundreds and hundreds of years, and your children are born into slavery, and you never see a sign that this is going to be any different. So this is not to dismiss the signs, the notion of actual hopeful signs, but it's to add something to it, which is that for me, faith in the struggle to change is tremendously important, and I always try to keep that alive. So having thrown that in, here's something that makes me hopeful, is even Hillary Clinton, in one of her campaign speeches, talked about the need for systemic change within the criminal justice system. I mean, that Bernie Sanders is running as a Democrat and talking about these issues in ways that will at least get some of it out in front of the people, the public. That Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation wouldn't allow a Republican candidate to not talk about criminal justice as an attitudinal thing. I mean, he was pushing for the guy to talk about it as systemic. So those are little hopeful signs for me. And again, I think that the fact that it is interfaith, so, I mean, you know, and here I am. I always describe myself when we're in the steering committee meetings. I say I'm the heathen who's on board, and ICPJ is welcoming of the presence of the heathen. ICPJ has been welcoming of the presence of, and even digs up, says, come on out, you know, come out from wherever you are and make your presence known, make your beliefs known within the broader human community, that feeling of being willing to allow anybody, regardless of their backgrounds, to allow anybody to be to express him, herself, themselves, is tremendously important. And you mentioned, Jane, that ICBJ has been around for a while, you know, since the 60s. And that sense of longevity and of not giving up itness. I think, you know, people know that there's something there that they can hook back into even if they leave and return. And just that rest, the commitment, the capacity to wrestle with each other. You know, that I feel with ICPJ more than I have with any other organization, and I've been with several organizations where the organization has like a platform or it has a philosophy or something, and then everybody else who disagrees or who is different, that organization, the organization I've been a part of, has found a way to prove the other organization wrong or has struggled to try to make them wrong. And I've never felt that within ICPJ, the feeling of making somebody else wrong or of needing to be right in order to be a part of what's going on. You know, there's the sense that we together will find something better for all of us.